recited their verse narratives to crowds of pilgrims in front of churches and shrines, sometimes accompanying themselves on the viol, just the way Aliena had told him. Jack approached everyone and asked if he had known Jack Scherberg. They all said no. The churches he saw on his way through southwest France and northern Spain continued to astonish him. They were all much higher than the English cathedrals. Some of them had banded barrel vaults. The bands, reaching from pier to pier across the vault of the church, made it possible to build in stages, bay by bay, instead of all at once. They also changed the look of a church. By emphasizing the divisions between bays, they revealed that the building was a series of identical units, like a sliced loaf, and this imposed order and logic on the huge interior space. He was in Compostela at midsummer. He had not known there were places in the world that were so hot. Santiago was another breathtakingly tall church, and the nave, still under construction, also had a banded barrel vault. From there he went farther south. The kingdoms of Spain had been under Saracen rule until recently. Indeed, most of the country south of Toledo was still Muslim-dominated. The appearance of Saracen buildings fascinated Jack. Their high, cool interiors, their arcades of arches, their stonework, blinding white in the sun. But most interesting of all was the discovery that both rib vaulting and pointed arches featured in Muslim architecture. Perhaps this was where the French had got their new ideas. He could never work on another church like Kingsbridge Cathedral, he thought as he sat in the warm Spanish afternoon, listening vaguely to the laughter of the women somewhere deep in the big, cool house. He still wanted to build the most beautiful cathedral in the world, but it would not be a massive, solid, fortress-like structure. He wanted to use the new techniques, the rib vaults and the pointed arches. However, he thought he would not use them in quite the way they had been used so far. None of the churches he had seen had made the most of the possibilities. A picture of a church was forming in his mind. The details were hazy, but the overall feeling was very strong. It was a spacious, airy building, with sunlight pouring through its huge windows, and an arched vault so high it seemed to reach heaven. "Joseph and Ryle will need a house," Rashid said suddenly. "If you were to build it, other work would follow." Jack was startled. One thing he had not thought of building was houses. "Do you think they want me to build their house?" he said. "They might." There was another long silence, during which Jack contemplated life as a house builder for wealthy merchants in Toledo. Eventually Rashid seemed to come awake. He sat upright and opened his eyes wide. "I like you, Jack," he said. "You're an honest man, and you're worth talking to, which is more than can be said for most people I've met. I hope we will always be friends." "So do I," said Jack, somewhat surprised by this unprompted tribute. "I'm a Christian, so I don't keep my women locked away as some of my Muslim brothers do. On the other hand, I'm Arab, which means I don't give them quite the, forgive me, the license that other women are used to. I allow them to meet and talk with male guests at the house. I even allow friendship to develop. But at the point where friendship begins to ripen into something more, as happens so naturally among young people, then I expect the man to make a formal move. Anything else would be an insult." "Of course," Jack said. "I knew you'd understand." Rashid stood up and put an affectionate hand on Jack's shoulder. "I've never been blessed with a son, but if I had, I think he would have been like you." On impulse, Jack said, "But darker, I hope." Rashid looked blank for a moment, then he roared with laughter, startling the other guests around the courtyard. "Yes," he said merrily, "darker," and he went into the house, still guffawing. The older guests began to take their leave. Jack sat by himself, thinking over what had been said to him as the afternoon cooled. He was being offered a deal, there was no question of that. If he married Aisha, Rashid would launch him as a house builder to the wealthy of Toledo. There was also a warning. If he did not intend to marry her, he should stay away. The people of Spain had more elaborate manners than the English, but they could make their meaning plain when necessary. When Jack reflected on his situation, he sometimes found it incredible. "Is this me?" he thought. "Is this Jack Jackson, bastard son of a man who was hanged, brought up in the forest, apprentice mason, escaped monk? Am I really being offered the beautiful daughter of a wealthy Arab merchant, plus a guaranteed living as a builder in this balmy city? It sounds too good to be true. I even liked the girl." The sun was going down and the courtyard was in shadow. There were only two people left in the arcade, himself and Joseph. He was just wondering whether this situation could have been contrived when Raya and Aisha appeared, proving that it had. Despite the theoretical strictness about physical contact between girls and young men, their mother knew exactly what was happening, and Rashid probably did too. They would give the sweethearts a few moments of solitude. Then, before they had time to do anything serious, the mother would come out into the courtyard, pretending to be outraged, and order the girls back inside. On the other side of the courtyard, Raya and Joseph immediately started kissing. Jack stood up as Aisha approached him. She was wearing a floor-length white dress of Egyptian cotton, a fabric Jack had never seen before he came to Spain. Softer than wool and finer than linen, it clung to Aisha's limbs as she moved, and its white color seemed to glow in the twilight. It made her brown eyes look almost black. She stood close to him, grinning impishly.
"What did he say to you?"
she said. Jack guessed she meant her father. "He offered to set me up as a house builder."
"What a dowry," she said scornfully. "I can't believe it.
At least he might have offered you money." She had no patience with traditional Saracen indirection, Jack observed wryly. He found her frankness refreshing. "I don't think I want to build houses," he said. She suddenly became solemn.
"Do you like me?"
"You know I do." She took a step forward, lifted her face, closed her eyes, stood on tiptoe and kissed him. She smelled of musk and ambergris. She opened her mouth, and her tongue darted between his lips playfully. His arms went around her almost involuntarily. He rested his hands on her waist. The cotton was very light. It was almost like touching her bare skin. She took his hand and raised it to her breast. Her body was lean and taut, and her breast was shallow, like a small firm mound, with a tiny hard nipple at its tip. Her chest moved up and down as she became aroused. Jack was shocked to feel her hand moving between his legs. He squeezed her nipple between her fingertips. She gasped and broke away from him, panting. He dropped his hands.
"Did I hurt you?" he whispered.
"No," she said. He thought of Aliena and felt guilty. Then he realized how foolish that was. Why should he feel that he was betraying a woman who had married another man? Aisha looked at him for a moment. It was almost dark, but he could see that her face was suffused with desire. She lifted his hand and put it back on her breast.
"Do it again, but harder," she said urgently.
He found her nipple and leaned forward to kiss her, but she pulled her head back and watched his face while he caressed her. He squeezed her nipple gently, then, obediently, pinched it hard. She arched her back so that her flat breast protruded, and her nipples made small hard puckers in the fabric of her dress. Jack bent his head to her breast. His lips closed around her nipple through the cotton. Then on impulse he took it between his teeth and bit down. He heard her sharp intake of breath. He felt a shudder pass through her. She lifted her head from her breast and pressed herself against him. He bent his face to hers. She kissed him frantically, as if she wanted to cover his face with her mouth, and pulled his body to hers, making small, panicky sounds in the back of her throat. Jack was aroused, bewildered, and even a little scared. He had never known anything like this. He thought she was about to reach a climax. Then they were interrupted. Her mother's voice came from the doorway.
"Raya! Aisha! Come inside at once!"
Aisha looked up at him, panting. After a moment, she kissed him again, hard, pressing her lips against his until she bruised him. She broke away.
"I love you," she hissed.
Then she ran into the house. Jack watched her go.
Raya followed her at a more sedate pace. Their mother flashed a disapproving look at him and Joseph, and then went in after the girls, shutting the door decisively behind her. Jack stood staring at the closed door, wondering what to make of it all. Joseph crossed the courtyard and interrupted his reverie. "Such beautiful girls, both of them," he said with a conspiratorial wink. Jack nodded absently and moved toward the gate. Joseph went with him. As they passed under the arch, a servant materialized out of the shadows and closed the gate behind them. Joseph said, "The trouble with being engaged is that it leaves you with an ache between the legs." Jack made no reply. Joseph said, "I might go down to Fatima's to get it eased." Fatima's was the whorehouse. Despite its Saracen name, nearly all the girls were light-skinned, and the few Arab whores were very high-priced. "Do you want to come?" Joseph said. "No," Jack replied. "I've got a different kind of ache. Good night." He walked quickly away. Joseph was not his favorite companion at the best of times, and tonight Jack found himself in an unforgiving mood. The night air cooled as he headed back toward the college where he had a hard bed in the dormitory. He felt he was at a turning point. He was being offered a life of ease and prosperity, and all he had to do was forget Aliena and abandon his aspiration to build the most beautiful cathedral in the world. That night he dreamed that Aisha came to him, her naked body slippery with scented oil, and she rubbed herself against him, but would not let him make love to her. When he woke up in the morning, he had made his decision. The servants would not let Aliena into the house of Rashid al-Harun. She probably looked like a beggar, she thought, as she stood outside the gate, in her dusty tunic and worn boots, with her baby in her arms. "Tell Rashid al-Harun that I am seeking his friend Jack Fitzjack from England," she said in French, wondering if the dark-skinned servants could understand a single word. After a muttered consultation in some Saracen tongue, one of the servants, a tall man with coaly skin and hair like the fleece of a black sheep, went into the house. Aliena fidgeted restlessly while the other servants stared at her openly. She had not learned patience even on this interminable pilgrimage. After her disappointment at Compostela, she had followed the road into the interior of Spain, to Salamanca. No one there remembered a red-haired young man interested in cathedrals and jongleur, but a kindly monk told her that there was a community of English scholars at Toledo. It seemed a faint hope, but Toledo was not much farther down the dusty road, so she pressed on. Another tantalizing disappointment had been waiting for her here. Yes, Jack had been here. What a stroke of luck! But alas, he had already left. She was catching up with him. She was now only a month behind him. But once again nobody knew where he had gone. In Compostela, she had been able to guess that he must have gone south, because she had come from the east and there was sea to the north and west. Here, unfortunately, there were more possibilities. He might have gone northeast back toward France, west to Portugal, or south to Granada, and from the Spanish coast he might have taken ship for Rome, Tunis, Alexandria, or Beirut. Aliena had decided to give up the search if she did not get a strong indication of which way he had gone when he left here. She was bone-weary and a long way from home. She had very little energy or determination left, and she could not face going farther with no more than a faint hope of success. She was ready to turn around and go back to England and try to forget about Jack forever. Another servant came out of the White House. This one was dressed in more costly clothes and spoke French. He looked at Aliena warily, but addressed her politely. "You are a friend of Mr. Jack?" "Yes, an old friend from England. I would like to speak with Rashid al-Harun." The servant glanced at the baby. Aliena said, "I'm a relative of Jack's." It was not untrue. She was the estranged wife of Jack's stepbrother, and that was a relationship. The servant opened the gate wider and said, "Please, come with me." Aliena stepped inside gratefully. If she had been turned away here, it would have been the end of the road. She followed the servant across a pleasant courtyard, past a splashing fountain. She wondered what had drawn Jack to the home of this wealthy merchant. It seemed an unlikely friendship. Had Jack recited verse narratives in these shady arcades? They went into the house. It was a palatial home with high, cool rooms, floors of stone and marble, and elaborately carved furniture with rich upholstery. They went through two archways and a wooden door, and then Aliena had the feeling they might have entered the women's quarters. The servant held up his hand for her to wait, then coughed gently. A moment later a tall Saracen woman in a black robe glided into the room, holding a corner of her garment up in front of her mouth, in a pose that was insulting in any language. She looked at Aliena and said in French, "Who are you?" Aliena drew herself up to her full height. "I am the Lady Aliena, daughter of the late Earl of Shiring," she said as haughtily as she could. "I take it I have the pleasure of addressing the wife of Rashid the Pepperseller?" She could play this game as well as anyone. "What do you want here?" "I came to see Rashid. He doesn't receive women." Aliena realized she had no hope of gaining this woman's cooperation. However, she had nowhere else to go, so she kept trying. "He may receive a friend of Jack's," she persisted. "Is Jack your husband?"
"No."
Aliena hesitated. "He's my brother-in-law." The woman looked skeptical. Like most people, she probably assumed that Jack had impregnated Aliena, then abandoned her, and Aliena was pursuing him with the object of forcing him to marry her and support the child. The woman half turned and called out something in a language Aliena did not understand. A moment later, three young women came into the room. It was obvious from their looks that they were her daughters. She spoke to them in the same language, and they all stared at Aliena. There followed a rapid conversation in which the syllable Jack recurred often. Aliena felt humiliated. She was tempted to turn on her heel and walk out, but that would mean giving up her search altogether. These awful people were her last hope. She raised her voice, interrupting their conversation, and said, "Where is Jack?" She intended to be forceful, but to her dismay her voice just sounded plaintive. The daughters fell silent. The mother said, "We don't know where he is." "When did you see him last?" She hesitated. She did not want to answer, but she could hardly pretend not to know when she had seen him last. "He left Toledo the day after Christmas," she said reluctantly. Aliena forced a friendly smile. "Do you recall his saying anything about where he might be going?" "I told you. We don't know where he is." "Perhaps he said something to your husband." "No, he did not." Aliena despaired. She had an intuitive feeling that the woman did know something. However, it was clear that she was not going to reveal it. Aliena felt suddenly weak and weary. With tears in her eyes, she said, "Jack is the father of my child. Don't you think he would like to see his son?" The youngest of the three daughters started to say something, but the mother interrupted her. There was a short, fierce exchange. Mother and daughter had the same fiery temperament. But in the end, the daughter shut up. Aliena waited, but no more was said. The four of them just stared at her. They were unquestionably hostile, but they were so curious that they were in no hurry to see her go. However, there was no point in staying. She might as well get out, go back to her lodgings, and make preparations for the long journey back to Kingsbridge. She took a deep breath and made her voice cool and steady. "I thank you for your hospitality," she said. The mother had the grace to look slightly ashamed. Aliena left the room. The servant was hovering outside. He fell into step beside her and escorted her through the house. She blinked back tears. It was unbearably frustrating to know that her whole journey had failed because of the malice of one woman. The servant led her across the courtyard. As they reached the gate, Aliena heard running footsteps. She looked back to see the youngest daughter coming after her. She stopped and waited. The servant looked uneasy. The girl was short and slender and very pretty, with golden skin and eyes so dark they were nearly black. She wore a white dress and made Aliena feel dusty and unwashed. She spoke broken French. "Do you love him?" she blurted. Aliena hesitated. She realized she had no more dignity left to lose.
Yes, I love him, she confessed.
Does he love you?
Aliena was about to say yes. Then she realized she had not seen him for more than a year.
He used to, she said.
I think he loves you, the girl said.
What makes you say that?
The girl's eyes filled with tears. I wanted him for myself, and I nearly got him. She looked at the baby, red hair and blue eyes. The tears ran down her smooth brown cheeks. Aliena stared at her. This explained her hostile reception. The mother had wanted Jack to marry this girl. She could not have been more than 16, but she had a sensual look that made her seem older. Aliena wondered exactly what had happened between them. She said,
You nearly got him?
Yes, the girl said defiantly. I knew he liked me. It broke my heart when he went away. But now I understand.
She lost her composure and her face crumpled in grief. Aliena could feel for a woman who had loved Jack and lost him. She touched the girl's shoulder in a comforting gesture, but there was something more important than compassion.
Listen, she said urgently, do you know where he went?
The girl looked up and nodded, sobbing.
Tell me.
Paris, she said.
Paris. Aliena was jubilant. She was back on the trail. Paris was a long way, but the journey would be mostly over familiar ground, and Jack was only a month ahead of her. She felt rejuvenated.
I'll find him in the end, she thought. I know I will.
Are you going to Paris now? The girl said.
Oh, yes, Aliena said. I've come this far. I won't stop now.
Thank you for telling me.
Thank you.
I want him to be happy, she said simply. The servant fidgeted discontentedly. He looked as if he thought he might get into trouble over this.
Aliena said to the girl, Did he say anything else? Which road he would take or anything that might help me?
He wants to go to Paris, because someone told him they are building beautiful churches there.
Aliena nodded. She could have guessed that.
And he took the weeping lady.
Aliena did not know what she meant.
The weeping lady? My father gave him the weeping lady.
A lady?
The girl shook her head.
I don't know the right words. A lady. She weeps. From the eyes.
You mean a picture? A painted lady?
I don't understand, the girl said. She looked over her shoulder anxiously. I have to go.
Whatever the weeping lady was, it did not sound very important.
Thank you for helping me, Aliena said.
The girl bent down and kissed the baby's forehead. Her tears fell on his plump cheeks. She looked up at Aliena.
I wish I were you, she said.
Then she turned away and ran back into the house. Jack's lodgings were in the Rue de la Boucherie, in a suburb of Paris on the left bank of the Seine. He saddled his horse at daybreak. At the end of the street he turned right and passed through the tower gate that guarded the Petit Pont, the bridge that led to the island city in the middle of the river. The wooden houses on either side projected over the edges of the bridge. In the gaps between the houses were stone benches where, later in the morning, famous teachers would hold open-air classes. The bridge took Jack into the Juiverie, the island's main street. The bakeries along the street were packed with students buying their breakfast. Jack got a pastry filled with cooked eel. He turned left opposite the synagogue, then right at the King's Palace, and crossed the Grand Pont, the bridge that led to the right bank. The small, well-built shops of the money changers and goldsmiths on either side were beginning to open for business. At the end of the bridge he passed through another gatehouse and entered the fish market, where business was already brisk. He pushed through the crowds and started along the muddy road that led to the town of Saint-Denis. When he was still in Spain, he had heard from a travelling mason about Abbot Suger and the new church he was building at Saint-Denis. As he made his way northward through France that spring, working for a few days whenever he needed the money, he heard Saint-Denis mentioned often. It seemed the builders were using both of the new techniques, rib vaulting and pointed arches, and the combination was rather striking. He rode for more than an hour through fields and vineyards. The road was not paved, but it had milestones. It passed the hill of Montmartre, with a ruined Roman temple at its summit, and went through the village of Clignancourt. 3 miles after Clignancourt, he reached the small walled town of Saint-Denis. Denis had been the first bishop of Paris. He had been decapitated at Montmartre, and then had walked, carrying his severed head in his hands, out into the countryside to this spot where at last he fell. A pious woman had buried him, and a monastery had been erected over his grave. The church had become the burying place for the kings of France. The current abbot, Suger, was a powerful and ambitious man who had reformed the monastery and was now modernizing the church. Jack entered the town and reined in his horse in the middle of the marketplace to look up at the west front of the church. There was nothing revolutionary here. It was a straightforward, old-fashioned facade with twin towers and 3 round-arched doorways. He rather liked the aggressive way the piers thrust out from the wall, but he would not have ridden 5 miles to see that. He tied his horse to a rail in front of the church and went closer. The sculpture around the 3 portals was quite good, lively subjects, precisely chiseled. Jack went in. Inside, there was an immediate change. Before the nave proper, there was a low entryway or narthex. As Jack looked up at the ceiling, he experienced a surge of excitement. The builders had used rib vaulting and pointed arches in combination here, and Jack saw in a flash that the 2 techniques went together perfectly. The grace of the pointed arch was accentuated by the ribs that followed its line. There was more to it. In between the ribs, instead of the usual web of mortar and rubble, this builder had put cut stones, as in a wall. Being stronger, the layer of stones could probably be thinner and therefore lighter, Jack realized. As he stared up, craning his neck until it ached, he understood a further remarkable feature of this combination. 2 pointed arches of different widths could be made to reach the same height, merely by adjusting the curve of the arch. This gave the bay a more regular look. It could not be done with round arches, of course. The height of a semicircular arch was always half its width, so a wide one had to be higher than a narrow one. That meant that in a rectangular bay, the narrow arches had to spring from a point higher up the wall than the springing of the wide ones, so that their tops would be at the same level and the ceiling would be even. The result was always lopsided. This problem had now vanished. Jack lowered his head and gave his neck a rest. He felt as jubilant as if he had just been crowned king. This, he thought, was how he would build his cathedral. He looked into the main body of the church. The nave itself was clearly quite old, although relatively long and wide. It had been built many years ago by someone other than the current master, and it was quite conventional. But then, at the crossing, there seemed to be steps down, no doubt leading to the crypt and the royal tombs, and steps up to the chancel. It looked as if the chancel were floating a little way above the ground. The structure was obscured from this angle by dazzling sunlight coming through the east windows, so much that Jack supposed the walls must be unfinished and the sun shining through the gaps. He walked along the south aisle to the crossing. As he got nearer to the chancel, he sensed that something quite remarkable was ahead of him. There was, indeed, sunlight pouring in, but the vault appeared to be complete, and there were no gaps in the walls. When Jack stepped out of the aisle into the crossing, he saw that the sun was streaming in through rows of tall windows, some of them made of colored glass, and all this sunshine seemed to fill the vast empty vessel of the church with warmth and light. Jack could not understand how they had got so much window area. There seemed to be more window than wall. He was awestruck. How had this been done, if not by magic? He felt a frisson of superstitious dread as he mounted the steps that led up to the chancel. He stopped at the top of the stair and peered into the confusion of shafts of colored light and stone that was ahead of him. Slowly the realization came over him that he had seen something like this before. But in his imagination, this was the church he had dreamed of building, with its vast windows and surging vaults, a structure of light and air that seemed held up by enchantment. A moment later he saw it differently. Everything fell into place quite suddenly, and in a lightning flash of revelation, Jack saw what Abbot Suger and his builder had done. The principle of rib vaulting was that a ceiling was made of a few strong ribs, with the gaps between the ribs filled in with light material. They had applied that principle to the whole building. The wall of the chancel consisted of a few strong piers joined by windows. The arcade separating the chancel from its side aisles was not a wall, but a row of piers joined by pointed arches, leaving wide spaces through which the light from the windows could fall into the middle of the church. The aisle itself was divided in two by a row of thin columns. Pointed arches and rib vaulting had been combined here, as they had in the narthex, but it was now clear that the narthex had been a cautious trial for the new technology. By comparison with this, the narthex was muscle-bound, its ribs and mouldings too heavy, its arches too small. Here everything was thin, light, delicate, and airy. The simple roll mouldings were all narrow, and the colonnettes were long and thin. It would have looked too fragile to stay upright, except that the ribs showed so clearly how the weight of the building was being carried by the piers and columns. Here was a visible demonstration that a big building did not need thick walls with tiny windows and massive piers. Provided the weight was distributed precisely on a load-bearing skeleton, the rest of the building could be light stonework, glass, or empty space. Jack was spellbound. It was almost like falling in love. Euclid had been a revelation, but this was more than a revelation, for it was beautiful, too. He had had visions of a church like this, and now he was actually looking at it, touching it, standing under its sky-high vault. He walked around the curved east end in a daze, staring at the vaulting of the double aisle. The ribs arched over his head like branches in a forest of perfect stone trees. Here, as in the narthex, the filling between the ceiling ribs was cut stone, jointed with mortar, instead of the easier but heavier rubble and mortar. The outer wall of the aisle had pairs of big windows with pointed tops to match the pointed arches. The revolutionary architecture was perfectly complemented by the colored windows. Jack had never seen colored glass in England, but he had come across several examples in France. However, in the small windows of an old-style church it could not achieve its full potential. Here, the effect of the morning sun pouring through the rich, many-colored windows was more than beautiful. It was spellbinding. Because the church was round-ended, the side aisles curved around to meet at the east end, forming a semicircular ambulatory or walkway. Jack walked all the way around the half-circle, then turned and came back, still marveling. He returned to his starting point. There he saw a woman. He recognized her. She smiled. His heart stood still. Aliena shaded her eyes. The sunlight coming through the windows at the east end of the church dazzled her. Like a vision, a figure walked toward her out of the blaze of colored sunshine. He looked as if his hair was on fire. He came closer. It was Jack. Aliena felt faint. He came to her and stood in front of her. He was thin, terribly thin, but his eyes shone with an intensity of emotion. They stared at one another in silence for a moment. When he spoke, his voice was hoarse. "Is it really you?" "Yes," she said. Her voice came out in a whisper. "Yes, Jack. It's really me." The tension was too much, and she began to cry. He put his arms around her and hugged her, with the baby in her arms between them, and patted her back, saying, "There, there," as if she were a child. She leaned against him, breathing his familiar dusty smell, hearing his dear voice as he soothed her, letting her tears fall on his bony shoulder. Eventually he looked at her face and said, "What are you doing here?" "Looking for you," she said. "Looking for me?" he said incredulously. "Then how did you find me?" She wiped her eyes and sniffed.
I followed you.
How?
I asked people if they had seen you. Masons mostly, but some monks and lodging housekeepers.
His eyes widened.
You mean, you've been to Spain?
She nodded. Compostela, then Salamanca, then Toledo.
How long have you been traveling?
3/4 of a year.
But why?
Because I love you.
He seemed overwhelmed. His eyes filled with tears.
He whispered, I love you too.
Do you?
Do you still?
Oh, yes.
She could tell he meant it. She tilted her face up. He leaned forward over the baby and kissed her softly. The touch of his mouth on hers made her feel dizzy.
The baby cried. She broke the kiss and rocked him a little, and he quieted.
Jack said, What's the baby called?
I haven't named him yet.
Why not? He must be a year old.
I wanted to consult you.
Me?
Jack frowned. What about Alfred? It's up to the father.
He tailed off.
Why, is he mine?
Look at him, she said. Jack looked.
Red hair.
It must be a year and 3/4 since...
Aliena nodded.
Good God, Jack said. He seemed awestruck.
My son.
He swallowed hard. She watched his face anxiously as he tried to take in the news. Would he see this as the termination of his youth and freedom? His expression became solemn. Normally a man had 9 months to get used to the idea of being a father. Jack had to do it all at once. He looked again at the baby, and at last he smiled.
Our son, he said. I'm so glad.
Aliena sighed happily. Everything was all right at last. Another thought struck Jack.
What about Alfred?
Does he know?
Of course.
He only had to look at the child.
Besides,
she felt embarrassed. Besides, your mother cursed the marriage, and Alfred was never able to, you know, do anything.
Jack laughed harshly.
There's true justice, he said. Aliena did not like the relish with which he said it.
It was very hard for me, she said, in a tone of mild reproof.
His face changed quickly.
I'm sorry,
he said. What did Alfred do?
When he saw the baby, he threw me out.
Jack looked angry. Did he hurt you?
No.
He's a pig all the same.
I'm glad he threw us out. It was because of that I came looking for you. And now I've found you. I'm so happy I don't know what to do.
You were very brave, Jack said. I still can't take it in.
You followed me all that way.
I'd do it all again, she said fervently. He kissed her again. A voice said in French, If you insist on behaving lewdly in church, please remain in the nave. It was a young monk. Jack said, I'm sorry, father. He took Aliena's arm. They went down the steps and across the south transept. Jack said, I was a monk for a while. I know how hard it is for them to look at happy lovers kissing.
Happy lovers, Aliena thought. That's what we are.
They walked the length of the church and stepped out into the busy market square. Aliena could hardly believe that she was standing in the sunshine with Jack by her side. It was almost too much happiness to bear.
Well, he said, what shall we do?
I don't know, she said, smiling. Let's get a loaf of bread and a flask of wine and ride out into the fields to eat our dinner.
It sounds like paradise.
They went to the baker and the vintner, and then they got a wedge of cheese from a dairy woman in the marketplace. In no time at all, they were riding out of the village into the fields. Aliena had to keep looking at Jack to make sure he really was there, riding along beside her, breathing and smiling. He said, How is Alfred managing the building site?
Oh, I haven't told you.
Aliena had forgotten how long he had been away.
There was a terrible disaster. The roof fell in.
What? Jack's loud exclamation startled his horse, and it did a skittish little dance. He calmed it.
How did that happen?
Nobody knows. They had 3 bays vaulted in time for Whitsunday, And then it all fell down during the service. It was dreadful. 79 people were killed.
That's terrible. Jack was shaken. How did Prior Philip take it?
Badly. He's given up building altogether. He seems to have lost all his energy. He does nothing nowadays.
Jack found it hard to imagine Philip in that state. He had always seemed so full of enthusiasm and determination.
So what happened to the craftsmen?
They all drifted away. Alfred lives in Shiring now and builds houses. Kingsbridge must be half empty.
It's turning back into a village, like it used to be.
I wonder what Alfred did wrong, Jack said half to himself. That stone vault was never in Tom's original plans, but Alfred made the buttresses bigger to take the weight, so it should have been all right. He was sobered by the news, and they rode on in silence. A mile or so out of Saint Denis, they tied up the horses in the shade of an elm tree and sat down in a corner of a field of green wheat, beside a little brook, to eat their dinner. Jack took a draught of the wine and smacked his lips.
England has nothing to compare with French wine, he said.
He broke the loaf and gave Aliena some. Aliena shyly undid the laced front of her dress and gave her nipple to the baby. She caught Jack looking at her and flushed. She cleared her throat and spoke to cover her embarrassment.
Do you know what you'd like to call him?
She said awkwardly.
Jack, perhaps?
I don't know. He looked thoughtful. Jack was the father I never knew. It might be bad luck to give our son the same name. The nearest I ever had to a real father was Tom Builder.
Would you like to call him Tom?
I think I would.
Tom was such a big man. How about Tommy?
Jack nodded. Tommy it is. Oblivious of the significance of the moment, Tommy had fallen asleep, having sucked his fill. Aliena put him down on the ground with a kerchief folded under his head for a pillow. Then she looked at Jack. She felt awkward. She wanted him to make love to her right there on the grass, but she felt sure he would be shocked if she asked him, so she just looked at him and hoped. He said, "If I tell you something, will you promise not to think badly of me?"
All right.
He looked embarrassed and said, "Ever since I saw you, I can hardly think of anything but the naked body under your dress." She smiled.
"I don't think badly of you,"
she said. "I'm glad." He stared at her hungrily. She said, "I love it when you look at me like that." He swallowed dryly. She held out her arms, and he came to her and embraced her. It was almost 2 years since the one and only time they had made love. That morning they had both been swept away by desire and regret. Now they were just two lovers in a field. Aliena suddenly felt anxious. Would it be all right? How terrible if something went wrong after all this time. They lay down on the grass, side by side, and kissed. She closed her eyes and opened her mouth. She felt his eager hand on her body, exploring urgently. There was a quickening in her loins. He kissed her eyelids and the end of her nose and said, "All this time, I ached for you every day." She hugged him hard. "I'm so glad I found you," she said. They made gentle, happy love in the open air, with the sun beating down on them and the stream burbling beside them, and Tommy slept through it all and woke up when it was over. The wooden statue of the lady had not wept since it left Spain. Jack did not understand how it worked, so he could not be sure why it would not weep outside its own country. However, he had an idea that the tears that came at nightfall were caused by the sudden cooling of the air, and he had noticed that sunsets were more gradual in northern territories, so he suspected that the problem had to do with the slower nightfall. He still kept the statue, however. It was rather bulky to carry around, but it was a souvenir of Toledo, and it reminded him of Rashid, and, although he did not tell Aliena this, of Aisha as well. But when a stonemason at Saint Denis wanted a model for a statue of the Virgin, Jack brought the wooden lady to the mason's lodge and left it there. He had been hired by the abbey to work on the rebuilding of the church. The new chancel, which had so devastated him, was not quite complete and had to be finished in time for the dedication ceremony at midsummer, but the energetic abbot was already preparing to rebuild the nave in the same revolutionary style,
and Jack was hired to carve stones in advance for that. The Abbey rented him a house in the village, and he moved in along with Aliena and Tommy. During the first night they spent in the house, they made love 5 times. Living together as man and wife seemed the most natural thing in the world. After a few days, Jack felt as if they had always lived together. Nobody asked whether their union had been blessed by the church. The master builder at Saint-Denis was the greatest mason Jack had ever met, easily. As they finished the new chancel and prepared to rebuild the nave, Jack watched the master and absorbed everything he did. The technical advances here were his, not the abbot's. Suger was in favor of new ideas in a general way, but he was more interested in ornament than structure. His pet project was the new tomb for the remains of Saint-Denis and his 2 companions, Rusticus and Eleutherius. The relics were kept in the crypt, but Suger planned to bring them up into the new chancel so the whole world could see them. The 3 caskets would rest in a stone tomb veneered with black marble. The top of the tomb was a miniature church made of gilded wood, and in the nave and side aisles of the miniature were 3 empty coffins, 1 for each of the martyrs. The tomb would stand in the middle of the new chancel, attached to the back of the new high altar. Both the altar and the base of the tomb were already in place, and the miniature church was in the carpenter's lodge, where a painstaking craftsman was carefully gilding the wood with priceless gold paint. Suger was not a man to do things by halves. The abbot was a formidable organizer, Jack observed, as preparations for the dedication ceremony accelerated. Suger invited everybody who was anybody, and most of them accepted, notably the King and Queen of France, and 19 archbishops and bishops, including the Archbishop of Canterbury. Such morsels of news were picked up by the craftsmen as they worked in and on the church. Jack often saw Suger himself, in his homespun habit, striding around the monastery giving instructions to a flock of monks who followed him like ducklings. He reminded Jack of Philip of Kingsbridge. Like Philip, Suger came from a poor background and had been brought up in the monastery. Like Philip, he had reorganized the finances and tightened up the management of the monastery's property so that it produced much more income. And like Philip, he was spending the extra money on building. Like Philip, he was busy, energetic, and decisive. Except that Philip was none of these things anymore, according to Aliena. Jack found that hard to imagine. A quiescent Philip seemed as unlikely as a kindly Walleran bygod. However, Philip had suffered a series of terrible disappointments. First, there had been the burning of the town. Jack shuddered when he recalled that awful day. The smoke, the fear, the dreadful horsemen with their flaming torches, and the blind panic of the hysterical mob. Perhaps the heart had gone out to Philip then. Certainly the town had lost its nerve afterward. Jack remembered it well. The atmosphere of fear and uncertainty had pervaded the place like a faint but unmistakable odor of decay. No doubt Philip had wanted the opening ceremony for the new chancel to be a symbol of new hope. Then, when it turned into another disaster, he must have given up. Now the builders had gone away, the market had declined, and the population was shrinking. Young people were beginning to move to Shiring, Aliena said. It was only a problem of morale, of course. The priory still had all its property, including the vast flocks of sheep, which brought in hundreds of pounds every year. If it were only a question of money, Philip could surely afford to recommence building on some scale. It would not be easy, certainly. Masons would be superstitious about working on a church that had already fallen down once, and it would be difficult to whip up the enthusiasm of the local people yet again. But the main problem, judging by what Aliena said, was that Philip had lost the will. Jack wished he could do something to help bring it back. Meanwhile, the bishops, archbishops, dukes, and counts began arriving at Saint-Denis 2 or 3 days before the ceremony. All the notables were taken on a conducted tour of the building. Suger himself escorted the most distinguished visitors, and lesser dignitaries were taken around by monks or craftsmen. They were all awestruck by the lightness of the new construction and the sunny effect of the huge windows of colored glass. As just about every important church leader in France was seeing this, it struck Jack that the new style was likely to be widely imitated. Indeed, masons who could say they had actually worked on Saint-Denis would be in great demand. Coming here had been a clever move, cleverer than he had imagined. It had greatly improved his chances of designing and building a cathedral himself. King Louis arrived on the Saturday with his wife and his mother, and they moved into the abbot's house. That night matins were sung from dusk to dawn. By sunrise there was a crowd of peasants and Parisian citizens outside the church, waiting for what promised to be the greatest assemblage of holy and powerful men that most of them would ever see. Jack and Aliena joined the crowd as soon as Tommy had been fed. One day, Jack thought, I'll say to Tommy, you don't remember it, but when you were just a year old, you saw the King of France. They bought bread and cider for their breakfast and ate while they were waiting for the show to begin. The public was not allowed into the church, of course, and the king's men-at-arms kept them at a distance. But all the doors were open, and people clustered in knots where they could see in. The nave was packed with the lords and ladies of the nobility. Fortunately, the chancel was raised several feet because of the large crypt under it, so Jack could still see the ceremony. There was a flurry of activity at the far end of the nave, and suddenly all the nobles bowed. Over their lowered heads Jack saw the king enter the church from the south. He could not see the king's face to make out his features, but his purple tunic made a vivid splash of color as he moved into the center of the crossing and knelt before the main altar. The bishops and archbishops came in immediately afterward. They were all dressed in dazzling white robes with gold embroidery, and each bishop carried his ceremonial crozier. The crozier was supposed to be a simple shepherd's crook, but so many of them were ornamented with fabulous jewels that the whole procession glittered like a mountain stream in the sunlight. They all walked slowly across the church and up the steps into the chancel, then took prearranged places around the font in which, Jack knew because he had observed the preparations, there were several gallons of holy water. There followed a lull, during which prayers were said and hymns were sung. The crowd became restless and Tommy got bored. Then the bishops moved off in procession again. They left the church by the south door and disappeared into the cloisters, much to the disappointment of the spectators. But then they emerged from the monastic buildings and filed across the front of the church. Each bishop carried a small brush called an aspergillum and a vessel of holy water, and as they marched, singing, they dipped the brushes in the water and sprinkled the walls of the church. The crowd surged forward, people begging for a blessing and trying to touch the snow-white robes of the holy men. The king's men-at-arms beat the people back with sticks. Jack stayed well back in the crowd. He did not want a blessing, and he preferred to stay away from those sticks. The procession made its stately way along the north side of the church, and the crowd followed, trampling over the graves in the cemetery. Some spectators had taken up positions here in anticipation, and they resisted the pressure from the newcomers. One or two fights broke out. The bishops passed the north porch and continued around the half-circle of the east end, the new part. This was where the craftsmen's workshops had been built, and now the crowd surged around the huts, threatening to flatten the light wooden buildings. As the leaders of the procession began to disappear back into the abbey, the more hysterical members of the crowd became desperate and pushed forward more determinedly. The king's men responded with increased violence. Jack began to feel anxious. I don't like the look of this, he said to Aliena. I was about to say the same, she replied. Let's get out of this crowd. Before they could move, a scuffle broke out between the king's men and a group of youths at the front. The men-at-arms laid about them fiercely with their clubs, but the youths, instead of cowering away, fought back. The last of the bishops hurried into the cloisters with a distinctly perfunctory sprinkling of the last part of the chancel. When the holy men were out of sight, the crowd turned its attention on the men-at-arms. Someone threw a stone and hit one of the men square on the forehead. A cheer went up as he fell. The hand-to-hand fighting spread quickly. Men-at-arms came running from the west front of the church to defend their comrades. It was turning into a riot. There was no hope of the ceremony providing a distraction in the next few moments. Jack knew that the bishops and the king were now descending into the crypt to fetch the remains of Saint-Denis. They would carry them all around the cloisters, but would not bring them out of doors. The dignitaries were not due to show themselves again until the service was over. Abbot Suger had not anticipated the size of the crowd of spectators, nor had he made arrangements to keep them happy. Now they were dissatisfied, they were hot, the sun was high by this time, and they wanted to vent their emotions. The king's men were armed, but the spectators were not, and at first the armed men got the better of it. Then someone had the bright idea of breaking into the craftsmen's huts for weapons. A pair of youths kicked down the door of the mason's lodge and came out a moment later with bolster hammers in their hands. There were masons in the crowd, and some of them pushed through the throng to the lodge and tried to stop people from going in, but they were unable to stand their ground and got shoved aside. Jack and Aliena were trying to retreat out of the crowd, but the people behind them were pressing forward urgently, and they found themselves trapped. Jack kept Tommy hard up against his chest, protecting the baby's back with his arms and covering the little head with his hands, at the same time struggling to stay close to Aliena. He saw a small, furtive-looking man with a black beard emerge from the mason's lodge, carrying the wooden statue of the weeping lady. "I'll never see that again," he thought with a pang of regret, but he was too busy trying to escape from the crush to worry about being robbed. The carpenter's lodge was broken open next. The craftsmen had given up hope of protecting their lodges, and they made no attempt to restrain the crowd. The smithy proved too strong, but the crowd burst through the flimsy wall of the roofer's lodge and took the heavy, wickedly sharp tools used for trimming and nailing lead sheets, and Jack thought, "Someone is going to be killed before this is over." Despite all his efforts, he was pushed forward toward the north porch where the fighting was fiercest. The same thing was happening to the black-bearded thief, he noticed. The man was trying to get away with his loot, hugging the wooden statue to his chest the way Jack was hugging Tommy, but he too was being forced farther into the melee by the press of the crowd. Suddenly Jack had a brainwave. He gave Tommy to Aliena, saying, "Stay close to me." Then he grabbed the little thief and wrested the statue away from him. The man resisted for a moment, but Jack was bigger, and anyway the thief was now more worried about saving his skin than stealing the statue, and after a moment he relinquished his hold. Jack lifted the statue above his head and started to shout, "Revere the Madonna!" At first nobody took any notice. Then one or two people looked at him. "Touch not the Holy Mother!" he shouted at the top of his voice. The people near him backed off superstitiously, making a space around him. He began to warm to his theme. "It is a sin to desecrate the image of the Virgin." He held the statue high above his head and walked forward toward the church. This just might work, he thought with a surge of hope. More people stopped fighting to see what was going on. He glanced behind him. Aliena was following, unable to do anything else because of the press of the crowd. However, the riot was rapidly simmering down. The crowd moved forward with Jack, and people began to repeat his words in an awestruck murmur. "It is the Mother of God! Hail Mary! Make way for the effigy of the Blessed Maiden!" All they wanted was a show, and now that Jack was giving them one, the fighting stopped almost completely, with only two or three continuing scuffles on the fringes. Jack marched forward solemnly. He was rather startled at the ease with which he had stopped a riot. The crowd fell away before him, and he reached the north porch of the church. There he set the statue down with great reverence in the cool shade of the doorway. It was a little over 2 feet high and seemed less impressive standing on the ground. The mob gathered around the doorway expectantly. Jack was at a loss to know what to do. They probably wanted a sermon. He had acted like a clergyman, bearing the statue on high and calling out sonorous warnings, but that was the limit of his priestly skills. He felt fearful. What might the crowd do to him if he disappointed them now? Suddenly, they gave a collective gasp. Jack looked behind him. Some of the nobles from the congregation had gathered in the north transept, looking out, but he could see nothing to justify the crowd's apparent amazement. "A miracle," someone said, and others took up the cry. "A miracle! A miracle!" Jack looked at the statue, and then he understood. Water was dripping from its eyes. At first he was as awestruck as the crowd. But a moment later he recalled his theory that the lady wept when there was a sudden change from warm to cold, as happened at nightfall in southern regions. The statue had just been moved from the heat of the day into the cool of the north porch. That would explain the tears. But the crowd did not know that, of course. All they saw was a